Salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, November 17th of the year 2017. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's so glad to be back with you here for yet another week as we are quickly running out of weeks here in the calendar year of 2017. If you haven't noticed, Christmas season seems to be in full effect, even earlier than normal. Perhaps that just feels like the case where we are here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Maybe it's the case where you are as well, listening to us abroad through the internet over iTunes, Google Play, and our website. We thank you all so much for joining us here from wherever you are.
Yes, indeed. Wherever you are is perhaps not where we are, but we are here and we will be here for a while. Who knows?
The next 90-ish minutes.
90-ish minutes, hopefully in your ears, and hopefully we will not annoy you to the point of turning us off. I am the other voice on this program, as I am every week. This week I'm Dennis, the man who still finds Wikipedia's random article button amusing.
After all these years.
Yeah, I mean, it's... there's just something satisfying or just something really funny to me about clicking through, you know, several random articles that are just seemingly like serious topics like lawmakers in the Philippines or, you know, some list of, you know, atoms discovered by German scientists or something. And then just after three or four of those, then you just happen upon some silly one like Frasier season 11. And it's just like, what? Very jarring, but very hilarious. Just the complete left turn that it takes you on every single time.
Mm-hmm. If you click long enough, you will eventually get one of those curveballs.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. And I don't know, I find when that happens, you almost have to stop yourself too, because you almost can get in the habit of just quickly clicking along.
Yeah.
Which is a tongue twister. I wouldn't recommend attempting that again.
Quickly clicking along. Indeed.
Too many L's.
Yes.
Occasionally, of course, a Simpsons episode sprinkled in there.
Yes. It only took, I think, like 7 or 8 reloads of the random article before that happened for me, but which is actually incredible considering how many millions of articles there are on Wikipedia that I just happened upon a random Simpsons episode. Fun times.
Wikipedia knows you quite well.
Hopefully it doesn't.
I always enjoy getting the random article on whatever sporting championship, some random arbitrary sporting event, like the cycling championships of 1950 to 51.
Yeah, like the 1946 German archery championships. Like, why is there a whole super long article about this? Like,
there's one person who's very passionate about it and wants to tell the world about the entire history of German archery championships.
And it's super well cited, which is the ridiculous part about, I mean, people can, you know, often quip about Wikipedia being, you know, well, anyone can put that information up there. But have you ever tried editing a Wikipedia page and seeing how quickly it gets put back? The Wikipedia community is crazy.
There's a lot of eyes on those pages.
Like, maybe more eyes than some academic journals?
Possible, and I think probably more eyes than what the general populace will give credit for, too.
Yeah, which is incredible. And I mean, it's not, like, crackpot stuff is always, you know, called out as being crackpot stuff, and it has sources always to, you know, to that effect, saying like, oh, like if you're going in some sort of, like, pseudoscience thing, there's always going to be a well-cited section where it's like the medical efficacy of this is in question or whatever, in case you're kind of concerned. Unless, of course, that's why you think Wikipedia is nonsense. But you're wrong, so good.
So if you have a few minutes today, perhaps during your workday, you need a little brain bath. You're going hard at the development, the coding, the filing, paperwork. It's one of those Fridays and you just kind of need a distraction, cause your brain's already kind of gone, but you're not physically gone yet. Wikipedia, random article button. worth it for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
And you know, it's Wikipedia, so it'll be more acceptable in the workspace than just pulling up Facebook or Twitter or what have you.
Or like Pornhub or something. Depending on your workspace, I don't know.
It depends on your boss.
I know my workspace would not be okay with that, but...
Pull it up in a meeting.
Yes.
All right, so now we're going to talk about, Pornhub. Yes.
It's like, whoa, why is that on my screen and now on the, big screen of the building? Whoops, sorry, everyone.
Yes, which is really just a deliberate slip on the part of, say, your boss or the person running the meeting just to gauge reaction and see, is this acceptable, actually?
Yes, even when, or maybe not when it's a client meeting, when you're sharing your screen with perhaps two or three universities, maybe you don't want to do that.
No, that'd be frowned upon, but, you know, there's always ways you can slip it in.
Yes, indeed.
Phrasing.
Absolutely.
But,
speaking of slipping it in, our first thing that we like to talk about is, we like to slip into something a little bit crazier than the rest of the news every week, and this week is no different.
That's not the connection I would have seen for a transition. I personally would have, circled back to the, medical pseudoscience discussions on Wikipedia topics and then brought it to the ludicrous lead-off.
We can loop it in.
You chose a different path, but...
Yes, it worked. Until it didn't work. When you ground it to a halt. But I'm making it work again. We're slipping in to the ludicrous lead-off. Which, it also deals with slipping it in a very non-sexual way.
In a medically sanctioned way.
Yes. By slipping it in, I mean DNA edits... into you.
Yes, it's been a while since we've had a ludicrous lead-off, a topic that falls under the category of science goes crazy. I think it's been a while, it's been a couple of weeks. They haven't been as prevalent this year as they have been in past years on the show, but, well, these things happen.
Yes.
There's enough crazy going on in the world, we'll let science kind of do its thing quietly, in the background.
Yeah, where I think it needs to be... A lot of times these days, unfortunately.
You just kind of do your thing in the underground, and it's fine. It's fine.
Yes.
Let the surface dwellers deal with the crazy. You just come out every so often with some good product and benefit for the rest of us who survive.
Or some insane thing for us to talk about, like today.
Certainly. And we have seen a number of cases in the past couple of years of therapies and advances in medical science that certainly seem and sound like something out of a science fiction or some piece of futurism or even something out of Futurama. And we've seen that a lot in the case of gene editing.
Yeah, I mean, CRISPR is not a new phrase by any means. It's been, the whole idea of it has been around for quite a while, but... And that's, in case you're not aware of what CRISPR is, it's sort of like literally a gene editor. It's just like, it's a technology used to edit genes of things.
Yes, outside the body. If you can almost imagine, like, say, an old editing machine for cutting films.
Yeah.
Like, you lay the film reel, the celluloid across, and literally you are cutting with a razor blade and then taping together new pieces of film.
Yeah.
Imagine that, but DNA.
Yeah, at a molecular level to DNA.
Yeah, it's a very oversimplified explanation, but gets the idea across.
Yeah, so, of course, you know, CRISPR is not a cut and dry thing because, of course, there's lots of, you know, ethical considerations to take into account and whatnot.
And it's still new. It is not without its hurdles or challenges or problems as well.
Like, I think that the most that they've done with CRISPR is maybe experimenting with very simple vegetables and whatnot, just to sort of get a handle on what's possible and what's not possible and what you should and shouldn't do. Like, for a while we thought that we were quite a ways off of, you know, experimenting with humans.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you don't typically jump right from, like, asparagus to human. Not that I'm saying that asparagus is what they used, but you get the idea.
Yes.
However, I think I was wrong.
And perhaps the technologies were more advanced than what we were aware of, because this week the Associated Press had the exclusive story on a new approach to gene editing that took the technology one step further, whereas CRISPR and those, because CRISPR isn't the only one, but that's just the most well-known name in terms of gene editing, dealt with splicing of genetics outside the human body. For the first time ever, doctors were performing a DNA editing procedure inside a human body, a living human body, this week. According to the Associated Press, 44-year-old Brian Madeau underwent the procedure, and he underwent the procedure because he suffers from a metabolic disease called Hunter syndrome, and that causes him to lack an enzyme which breaks down certain carbohydrates in his body. And the carbohydrates then kind of build up in his body and his cells and basically cause him a painful existence, a painful, unpleasant existence. And for this procedure, because if you're picturing editing, you might think that there's snipping and clipping and perhaps, you know, tiny robots or nanorobotics or something of that nature to literally snip things at a molecular level and physically cut them. Well, yes and no, because this procedure involved having the patient, Brian Madeau, hooked up to an IV drip, which then delivered billions of copies of a corrective gene into his body, along with a tool that is called zinc finger proteins, which is meant to cut his DNA in precisely the right spot in order to deliver the new corrective genes.
Yes, yeah, so this definitely sounds very much, actually, to me, like a specific episode of Futurama, wherein Fry ate the egg salad sandwich from a gas station vending machine, got very sick, but then also got very smart and really smart. And
he was functioning at peak performance.
Yes, after eating the sandwich, and then they discovered it was because there were some sort of parasites that were just repairing all of his neurons and whatnot. That's what this sort of reminds me of, just releasing stuff into your blood, like your body, I won't say bloodstream, probably bloodstream if it's IV, then somehow this tool just kind of knows where to cut and it knows how to get to your DNA and knows where to cut. Sounds crazy to me.
Yes, and this is where we're at now with science and therapies like this. This is crazy. So the injections were made into, you know, his blood system, but eventually they'll make their way into his liver, which is where I guess the problematic cells and genes are stored. And according to the Associated Press, only 1% of Madeau's liver cells would need to be corrected in order to effectively treat this Hunter syndrome. So within the first month, they'll know if something happened and it took, and within 3 months, they should know for certain whether this therapy is working.
However, the article does end on a bit of a disconcerting note, at least the Gizmodo article that brought this to our attention ends on a bit of a disconcerting note slash quote from one of the doctors who, well, it's a doctor who is not affiliated with the study, but he still gave a soundbite because I guess he's an expert in the field. It's Dr. Carl June from the University of Pennsylvania. When asked how bulletproof is this technology, he told the Affiliated Press, and I quote, "We're just learning." So
we're still in early days here.
Yeah.
For this technology, for this science, for this therapy. And this procedure was performed at the University of California, San Francisco, Beinhof Children's Hospital in Oakland, California. And Brian Madeau is the first patient to undergo a clinical trial using the zinc finger nucleases technique, which apparently is an alternative to the CRISPR method in order to treat his Hunter syndrome. And there are two additional trials underway which are using the same liver-targeted genome editing approach to treat hemophilia B and a condition called Hurler syndrome, which I cannot say I have any familiarity with. But needless to say, the long and short of it is gene editing is now being attempted inside the human body.
So I guess we've now bypassed all of those ethical concerns that gene editing kind of initially had, because yeah, like, remember when people were concerned that if you edit a gene, that means all future genes are going to be edited in the same kind of way?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have children, their genes are going to be edited. Now, obviously, this is fine. No one wants to pass on something like Hunter's syndrome to someone. No. And I'm assuming that things like cancer markers and stuff will eventually be found. And there's benefits to all of it, sure, but I don't know. I'm not an ethicist, so I can't really speak to these things. But where will this stop?
Well, I think that would be something that comes initially, I would think, far down the line. But then again, technology and science are moving faster than what we kind of thought. So those questions will likely have to be answered sooner than later.
Will there be a cure for male pattern baldness? Will I see that in my life? That's basically what I'm getting at. Can you fix the top of my head a little bit just to kind of fill it out a little bit more, like back to what it used to be? That'll be nice.
Possibly. I know they're still doing wonderful things with stem cells.
Well, I don't want to, like, if it's like an easy thing, like, oh, come in for your baldness shots that you just need once. Cool. Good thing I got that cleared up. Woo. Fine, but if it's like, oh, well, you're on a waiting list for stem cells, no, there might be a kid with a leg problem. It's like, no, just don't put me on a waiting list. Don't do anything stupid. Like, obviously, I could live with a receding hairline. This is...
They just take your own cells and kind of, you know, work them down to their own base level pluripotent stem cells, and then they'll just re-inject them into your scalp and...
Yeah, but that sounds like a lot of work for everyone.
Well, this is before they are able to distill it down just to a cream.
Okay, fine. Sure. But they'll sell them on one of those snake oil websites?
Well, yes. Look for it on Gwyneth Paltrow's Gloop.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
okay. Well, anyways, and on that note...
Along with the stickers that correct your, you know, internal magnetism or something. You know, things like that. I'm sure down the line there will be, because there will be a lot of money to be made with something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Cure for just baldness, hair loss, hair growth, anything of that nature.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you got a lot on your chin. You can't just transplant?
Well, no.
I mean, it's growing well on the chin.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
But just up there?
As a bearded man who can grow a beard quite well, if I do say so myself. I'm not...
And you just did?
Yes, I did. Anyways, we don't really...
We'll know, I'm sure, sooner than later in the future, if there is.
Yeah. We'll let you know if there's any sort of advancements in this field.
We have a link to the full Associated Press article if you want a longer read and perhaps a more in-depth and slightly more scientific read than what we can offer here on this program. Find it on our website in the show notes at thearcadeshow.com. But let's turn our attention now to matters more video game related, specifically video game award season related. As I mentioned off the top, there are really aren't too many weeks left in the calendar year of 2017, and as we are reaching this point in the month of November, the majority of major releases for the year of 2017 have now come out. There's maybe two or three other big titles waiting in the wings to come out for platforms between now and Christmas to try and pry people away from their dollars. So now really becomes the time when reflecting on the year begins in earnest. And, one of the ways that will happen is at the upcoming, 2017 Game Awards, which, have been announced to take place on December 7th from California. This will mark the, I believe, fourth or fifth incarnation of the Game Awards, which have, grown and grown for the past number of years, started off after Jeff Keighley really wanted to do a more, you know,
actual... More legit version?
A legit version of a video game award show after the Spike TV Video Game Awards died a slow and painful death.
Yeah, and even then they were never really the most legitimate seeming thing. They really kind of felt more like just ads for things.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you had money and you were a game company, your game could get featured in this program.
Exactly. If you paid enough, you could, well, you'd win whatever category. But this seems to be done with a lot more authenticity, with a very large panel of, I guess, deciders, panelists, judges. There we go. That's the word I was looking for. Judges and adjudicators to determine the winners in each category. And there's a lot of categories to choose from. We won't go over them all, because we actually do have other things to get to this week. If we didn't, this is great filler.
Yeah, but we can go through like 4, 5, maybe 6 categories or so. Of course, the most important category, top of everyone's mind, first thing in the list, is Game of the Year. It'll be the last thing announced at the game show, of course, but the most important one, the nominees are Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild and Super Mario Odyssey, both from Nintendo, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds by the PUBG Corp, Persona 5 by Atlus, and Horizon Zero Dawn by Guerrilla Games / Sony, which is some incredibly stiff competition.
That's a tough category.
Like, I feel that this year has been really, really good for game releases. There's just been a lot of good stuff put out by lots of companies. They're all really at the top of their game, I'd say, at this point.
I'd say so, and it hasn't always just been the very large companies, the very large studios releasing AAA killer stuff that dominates everything. It's a good mix between large publishers, small publishers, medium publishers, and developers, all being released. I mean, no surprise that we see the big 2 Switch releases on there. I think it's kind of been known and understood that Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, from its release back in March, is a Game of the Year candidate.
Oh, yeah. And as soon as it hit the shelves and hit the hands of the reviewers, it was also kind of understood, holy crap, Mario Odyssey is as well.
Yes, it is.
And, I mean, PUBG, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, has sort of...
It's been a phenomenon.
Yeah, and it's surprising. Like, it's not the best game in the world, but... And it is kind of an indie title.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing that it's picked up as much as it has. And, I mean, Persona 5 to represent, the big RPG.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
But mind you, for that token, so does Horizon Zero Dawn.
It does, which is a another big title from this year, released by Sony, or published by Sony, I should say, developed by Guerrilla Games.
And I'd say the only other title that could have possibly made Game of the Year, but didn't, but also shows up in a bunch of other categories, is Wolfenstein 2.
It does. While it wasn't nominated for Game of the Year, it did receive a nomination for Best Game Direction.
As well as Best Narrative and a few other, categories as well that we don't necessarily need to get into, but yeah.
So that's certainly one of the big ones. Another major release that actually doesn't see too many nominations is Assassin's Creed Origins.
Yeah.
Which I was a little bit surprised by.
Yeah, but speaking of indie titles, Cuphead does show up in several categories as well.
Rightfully so.
Also in Best Art Direction, but also in the Best Indie Game category, which also has some pretty, decent... Well, there's 2 independent game categories, actually. There's the Best Independent Game and the Best Debut Indie Game. Cuphead is in both of those categories. But, there's stiff competition in all of them. Best Independent Game, for example, has Pyre by Supergiant Games, Night in the Woods by Infinite Fall, Cuphead, Studio MDHR, What Remains of Edith Finch by Giant Sparrow / Annapurna Interactive, and Hellblade, Sayuna's Sacrifice from Ninja Theory. So some really good titles there.
There is. And then in the Best Debut Indie category, there's Cuphead, as you said, but also Golf Story, the golf-centric RPG.
Which sounds awesome.
Hollow Knight from Team Cherry.
Which also looked awesome.
Mr. Shifty from Team Shifty.
Yep.
And Slime Rancher from Monomi Park, which, that's a pretty solid category. And that's, the Best Indie Game or Best Debut indie game category is actually itself making its debut at this year's Game Awards.
Yeah. One of the Well, like, I take umbrage with one of the categories because it does feel a little bit unnecessary.
Which one?
And I feel like we talked about it last year as well, but it was the most anticipated game category. Like, that one is straight up just who paid the most to get their stuff in here.
Yeah, I'm going to say Jeff Keighley kind of learned some lessons from his Spike TV days of doing the Game Awards and whatnot and GTTV on Spike TV. I mean, there's a cost to putting on the show of the Game Awards, and a category like Most Anticipated Game helps cover those costs.
Yeah, of course.
That's all it is.
And I'm not even going to say any of the titles in that category, because they didn't pay us for that.
That's true.
So screw you, Most Anticipated Game.
If you can think of a major title coming out in 2018, then yes, it's nominated for Most Anticipated Game. That's as far as we'll go with that one. Other ones, I think another hotly contested category would be the one of Best Action Adventure, which sees three of the Game of the Year nominees competing against each other. That's Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild, Super Mario Odyssey, and Horizon Zero Dawn. They're all competing in that category of Best Action Adventure Game, along with Assassin's Creed Origins and Uncharted The Lost Legacy.
Yeah, but I also think that I'm probably most curious about who's going to win the Best Role-Playing Game category, because that is where we saw, I want to say, the only appearance of Final Fantasy XV, but also against Persona 5, which was one of the Game of the Year contenders, but also against one of the other big internet favorites, Nier Automata, and a couple others as well, Divinity Original Sin 2, which I actually just started playing the first Divinity Original Sin, and it's ridiculous, and I've heard that Original Sin 2 is even better.
Okay.
But also South Park, The Fractured But Whole, which I haven't played yet, but as soon as it comes on sale on the PlayStation Store, boy howdy, am I picking it up.
You're all over that like stink on a hog.
Absolutely.
I understand that. Best action game. I saw this category and thought, okay, best action game, and then saw right after that the best action adventure game category. I don't know what the criteria is for splitting those two categories, but Best Action Game sees nominations for Prey, Nioh, Destiny 2, Cuphead, and Wolfenstein 2, so kind of covering the whole gambit of the gaming spectrum right there, at the very least from Cuphead to Wolfenstein 2.
Yeah, a lot of these categories just seem like weird duplicates of each other. Like Games for Impact as well. Maybe not a duplicate category, but maybe also an unclear category. Maybe is it supposed to be a category that touches on issues? Because I guess I see Night in the Woods in there. I also see Life is Strange Before the Storm. I also see What Remains of Edith Finch, Hellblade, Please Knock on My Door, kind of indie-ish games, but maybe ones that deal with societal issues. Like, I know Night in the Woods deals with, like, mental health issues, and I think Life is Strange deals with relationship issues or something.
Something to that effect. I cannot say I am an authority on Life is Strange. I only have a very loose and tangential knowledge and familiarity with it, but there's a whole lot of categories to cover the whole gaming spectrum.
Yeah.
And I
Also, I like the best performance category too, because I feel that like a lot of people who do voiceovers for games maybe aren't praised as much as other voiceover artists, especially when there are a lot of them that are good. Like, you know, a lot of the people who are nominated in this category this year for very interesting characters, and it kind of cracks me up, a couple of them, but like, you know, there's a couple of people who played in Uncharted The Lost Legacy, obviously the game series that most closely resembles a movie.
True.
Laura Bailey as Nadine Ross and Claudia Black as Chloe Fraser. Melina Jurgens as Senua from Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice. Ashley Birch as Aloy from Horizon Zero Dawn. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. But also Brian Bloom as BJ Blazkowicz from Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus. good to know that BJ Blazkowicz now is an acted role.
Yes, to give a level of depth to the character, where in the past games maybe never had that.
He was just the dude who was killing zombies, or killing Nazis.
That's right.
The zombies of humanity.
This is very true.
Yes.
And what actually I have to say that I like about this, the nominees this year for the best performance category, there's no celebrity cameo. There's no big name actor who did a voice in a game and read lines nominated. It is almost strictly, non-big name voiceover talent.
Yeah, which is good because, you know, as much as it is awesome when, you know, a big name actor transitions into voice acting and becomes like a big name voice actor and is just great at it, like, you know, like a Mark Hamill or, you know, like Phil LaMarr or mm-hmm. any people like that. Like, it is great and, you know, respect to them, but it's also really cool when someone just kind of starts off as one thing and becomes really good at that thing and then just starts getting recognized for that thing.
It's true. And I think all too often it's too easy for the big name, celebrity actor, who perhaps does work in a video game to get acknowledgement, and recognition.
Yeah.
And perhaps just that name recognition factor can dwarf other really good voiceover artists.
Like, I can't help but be sort of reminded of Brutal Legend. As much as I like Brutal Legend, it was very much like, I know Jack Black. And I got Ozzy Osbourne, Lemmy, Kilmister, Rob Halford, and Lita Ford to be in this video game.
Mm-hmm.
These are all people you know, and no one that you don't. So, deal with that.
Yeah. Well, I also can't help but think of, we also see it too in movies, with animated movies. And I think that's one of the differences between, say, the Pixar movies, where they won't always have the, you know, big, most popular actor of the day. They'll go with a voice that more suits the character and the role. Think of the difference between, say, The Incredibles, or some of the, you know, more early Pixar movies, and what DreamWorks did with, say, the movie Shark Tale, which, if you ever remember the commercial for, was just a who's who of Hollywood actors and prominent names in movies.
Having said that, though, Toy Story did have kind of a huge star-studded cast.
Tom Hanks, the biggest name.
Yeah.
But other than that, what, Tim Allen?
Tim Allen was really popular at the time.
Tim Allen was the biggest name on, one of the biggest names on TV.
And Jim Barney, he was the dinosaur.
Oh, God.
No, he's the dog.
He was Slinky Dog. Yes.
But yeah, I don't know.
And Don Rickles as Mr. Potato Head?
That's true. That was definitely true.
Arlie Emery as the little green army guy?
That's also true. That's fantastic casting, by the way. but yeah, so very interesting. We'll obviously have more on this, or we'll report back after the Game Awards actually happen.
Yes, they are set to be handed out on Thursday, December 7th. And, yes, it's a bit of a bigger award show this year. They're incorporating more live performances, I think from bands and whatever orchestras performing pieces of video game music and arrangements.
Yeah, make more of a spectacle of it.
Yeah.
Bring it back more to the Spike TV type days.
A little bit, but still trying to balance it out. Yeah, still have the, you know, standard reveals, teases, and announcements of new games and things like that, and try to do it a bit more authentically without the television channel, you know, network executive in interference.
Yeah. But anyway, speaking more about reporting back on things, last week we talked about how GameStop was rolling out a program called the Power Pass program, which was supposed to allow you, a Power Pass member, to essentially be able to rent kind of an unlimited number of used games, as long as it's just one at a time. You take one out, you put it back, you take another one out, maybe like a library, I guess.
Yeah, like a library, and then at the end of your 6-month membership,
you get to keep one of the games that you
rented. Yes. It would cost you $60 for that 6-month membership, so $10 for 6 months. And
or $10 a month.
$10 a month for 6 months, excuse me. And it seemed like a neat idea to try and activate their used game collection, which, I mean, they have a lot of used games that are just kind of sitting there.
Yeah, and I went on record saying that I thought it was a good idea, and I went into reasons why, and surely they agree with me. However, they have already suspended their PowerPass program. They've called it a temporary pause, but it's not clear how temporary or if it's going to start back up again anytime soon.
And the funny thing is, it just launched this week.
Yeah.
And it was very quickly paused after launch.
Yeah, so it kind of teased a bunch of people in a very unsatisfying way.
And the interesting thing is, there really was not a reason given or a substantive reason given. When Kotaku, the writers of Kotaku, reached out to GameStop to find out why and what's up with the program, they heard back from one of the spokespeople who said, quote, "We have elected to temporarily pause the rollout of the new PowerPass subscription service based on a few program limitations we have identified. We feel this is the right thing to do for now to ensure we are able to provide our guests an exceptional service," end quote. Spokesperson later goes on to say, quote, quote, "For those guests who have already purchased the service, we will allow them to bring the pass and video game they have checked out back to receive a full refund. In addition, we will allow them to pick out any pre-owned game for free." So if you were one of those really, really Johnny-on-the-spot people, because I think this was only up for like 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And you went and took out a game, well, you gotta bring it back, but you get something for free. Now there's likely a limitation on it, you know, up to a certain, you know, amount for a pre-owned game. Like,
probably, yeah.
You know, I don't think you'll be able to get a used copy of Super Mario Odyssey or whatnot.
Well, maybe, if you're that Johnny on the spot, but, regardless, too bad, so sad. Interesting idea, but yeah, it's my understanding that some people had that were not official spokespeople that maybe the GameStop system was a little bit too old and dated.
Yeah, and perhaps the computer systems that they would use inside the stores. Some of the stores were just old.
Yeah, so I mean, much like a lot of long-standing brick and mortar retailers, their computer systems probably could use some work, but that work is going to be very expensive to update things, which is why you don't often see, you know, large chains that have computer inventory systems use computer inventory systems that look even remotely close to being up to date.
Of course not, because the old systems, well, they're still working, so...
They still work. Why would I spend money on upgrading those? Just learn all the key commands and you'll be fine.
Exactly. Oh, well, just put a post-it note on the side of the monitor. Yeah. There.
Now you know F12 means get to the next screen. Perfect.
I wonder how many brick-and-mortar retail stores still have the kind of old black and green screen, old DOS-style systems.
Quite a few that I've seen.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of furniture stores do. I'm not going to name any names, but... Yeah.
Did that blow your mind when you saw that?
No, not at all.
Really?
No, I know how expensive it would be for, like, a massive retail chain to upgrade, you know, an inventory database. Depending on how old the inventory database is, well, upgrading that to a newer system, it's unnecessary, and you're not going to get any value out of it, other than just aesthetics. Who cares about aesthetics when it comes to, you know, managing your core business? Does this thing manage your core business fine? Why do you need to change it?
True. And also, too, there's something to be said about the older systems. Stability.
Yeah.
Rock solid.
Less moving parts equals less moving parts to break.
This is true. The dumber something is, the less likely it is to break.
Exactly.
Just out of curiosity, what would be a ballpark figure for a furniture store to upgrade its inventory computer database system?
I couldn't even possibly begin to estimate that. But like my gut would say in the tens of millions of dollars at the least.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. Could you imagine, like, somewhere like a Target or something having to upgrade? Like, if they were still using, like, essentially something that looked like DOS, I don't think they are. I think they actually invest in infrastructure and stuff. They're one of the, those companies. Well, basically, companies that stay modern kind of don't end up in those terrible situations. But, yeah, it's a little bit surprising that GameStop, a merchant of technology, has such a crappy system like this.
And yet, this is obviously one of those areas where they don't value the investment. There's a number of GameStop stores where they've, you know, redone the interiors, kind of rejigged the placement of inventory, repositioned the sales counter and whatnot to try and create a better flow for the guest experience and that kind of thing. Something that a consultant charged them tens of thousands of dollars to tell them.
Oh, yeah, probably.
And yet the computer system. Well, it could be, too, that perhaps they just kind of piecemeal it and just kind of upgrade the computer system of stores as they go and update the stores. But then you just have end up inevitably with old stores that haven't been touched yet.
You also, I don't know if that would necessarily happen either, because you also end up with like a weird dog's breakfast of, oh, well, we need to make sure that we're running. We need to make sure that our system supports five different types of systems running in parallel, because we don't want to roll this all out at once, and we need to support legacy systems, and we need to support new systems, and the software developer in me is thinking that would be a nightmare. But regardless, no word on when that's coming back. We'll let you know when it, if we find out anything.
Yeah, if it does.
If it does, you might not hear it first here, but you'll hear it here.
You certainly will, just like you will hear it here that Electronic Arts, a company with a lot of capital in the gaming sphere and deciding to spend some of that capital, and by capital, I mean money, cash, moolah.
Lots and lots of money.
Dollars and cents.
Lots spelt with a Z at the end of it.
Cheddars, greenbacks, Benjamins. Not goodwill within the gaming community. Of course not, because it's EA. They're too big a company to have goodwill.
Yes.
They are one of those big tyrannical companies. That's just how it works. And as evidenced by the news late last week that they have purchased, formerly independent studio Respawn, for a deal that could reach upwards of $455 million, a number that includes cash, equity, and performance milestone bonuses. So this is a deal that apparently has been in the works for a couple of weeks, and according to what the sources speaking to Kotaku heard, kind of was prompted when another company called Nexon made a play to try and purchase Respawn for a couple hundred million. But because of whatever agreements were in place between Respawn and EA, Electronic Arts had the first right to match or, you know, pass up any offer that was made for Respawn, and then EA bought Respawn for $455 million. And so with that, they now control the Titanfall franchise, and to go along with this announcement, they also announced Titanfall 3 as being a game that will happen at some point in the future for EA to try and recoup some of its investment here. The name Respawn, you might kind of be remembering, I think I've heard that name before. It was the company that was started in 2010 when Jason West and Vince Zampella, they were the lead designers at Infinity Ward, which was a subordinate studio for Activision working on Call of Duty games.
Yep.
They made, I believe it was Modern Warfare 2, and then not long after that were promptly dismissed in a very long, drawn-out legal process that eventually saw them, I believe, paid tens of millions from Activision in back pay, overtime, performance bonuses. Basically, they were shit-canned for no real good cause.
Yeah.
And they took Activision to task and got paid.
Absolutely.
As they should have been. So they turned around and started Respawn in 2010, and not long after that, announced plans to make Titanfall, signed a publishing deal with EA, and I guess this was just a natural progress of that deal.
Yes.
So 7 years after starting, you sell out for $455 million. I'd say that's a good ROI.
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't be unhappy about that, that happening if it was me.
Now that, accordingly with this deal, well, Electronic Arts had to turn around and shut down one of their other studios. I believe it was Visceral Games that was working on a Star Wars game. That's been shuttered and I believe moved over to Respawn now. So basically the chance, basically they ditched one studio to spend a lot more and get Respawn.
Yeah.
And Titanfall for sure.
Yeah.
Fully under their control.
So let's see, if the new Titanfall game is full of DLC. Paid and, DLC.
And thus, microtransactions.
Thus further making all of the people mad at EA.
Hey.
Which has been happening quite a lot lately.
Yeah, that's, I think this might be the year people finally turn on microtransactions and DLC.
I mean, it's only been, what, 10 years since it's really started being, like, a problem? But I feel like with the whole loot box fiasco as well, how people are just looking at this going, this is gambling. You're mm-hmm. exploiting people. Like, this is no better than VLTs. Like, them saying, oh no, but you get to keep stuff in loot boxes. It's like, yeah, but that's not the idea. Like, people are still addicted to the thrill of not knowing what they're gonna get. It's gambling! It's total gambling! Like, oh my god. When you say that there's a small chance of getting something good, that's the same thing as going into a VLT and going, there's a small chance of winning the jackpot.
And to think, what, 10 years ago, people were aghast at the selling of horse armor for, what was it, Warcraft or something?
Yeah.
That was the, you know, not necessarily controversy, but the, flashpoint of...
I'd say even more, like, in hindsight, something that we would look at as being, like, a reasonable thing to pay money for, people back then were starting to get aghast at, you know, purchasing additional levels for games and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, you're getting something tangible out of it, not just the chance of something tangible.
That's right.
Or, you know, like purchasing something crappy like, you know, Darth Vader's helmet or something for the new Battlefront game for $5 or whatever it is. No, you were actually getting something, but people were still kind of mad back then, but a little bit like, well, at least I'm still getting something, but maybe we finally reached that critical mass where it's actually going to be unacceptable to keep doing this. Cause it's like, can you just release your game and like call it a day? And if you release another thing, just call it a new game and then stop, you know, piddling around with this whole microtransaction nonsense.
You see, apparently it's not enough to just release your game into the wild anymore. You have to find a way to have it be almost an evergreen source of revenue, you know, to continually monetize it year after year so it can further pad the bottom line and make the share's price, stock price, look that much better. Which I'm sure Warner Brothers is going to want to do and Time Warner will want to do because in other gaming business news, they have announced, Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment has, that they're opening up a new label, publishing label called Portkey Games. Now, they haven't bought Respawn or any other small studios, but what this is it's going to be a division of Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment that is solely focused on producing Harry Potter video games and, I guess, electronic experiences, pulling from both the book universe and the movie series of Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And I think up to this point, we've really only seen games based on the movie series that I can recall, both initially when the movie series was still being released, and then also the Lego ones as well.
Yeah, but I mean, the Harry Potter is a rich world, rich wizarding world, and you know, certainly this will make a lot of people happy. At least this is what Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment President David Hubbard is hoping, and I quote, with Portkey Games, we're thrilled to answer the fans' request for more games inspired by J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. We are working with talented creators to build games that focus on player-generated stories, which will live alongside the magical universe created by J.K. Rowling. End quote.
And so in the press release, they, tease that there will be games and fans and gamers will see, new characters and old characters. But it also has one line in there that kind of caught a lot of people's attention where it says that fans will be able to see some familiar characters, quote, at different points in their lives. So potentially there would be games telling the story of Harry Potter after the end of the novels and what happens as he goes about trying to live his life with his, wife and child and just trying to be a normal human.
Yeah.
Or, well, normal.
As normal as Harry Potter could be.
Yes, a normal quote-unquote life for Harry Potter. So we've seen a number of games from EA, Lego versions. There was even a Quidditch World Cup game, because of course there would be. But the only new game announced to come out of this announcement of the publishing label for Harry Potter games is, of all things, a mobile augmented reality game.
Yeah.
Which I have to say is not what I would have thought of first.
Yeah, also, you'll probably have similar thoughts that I have when you find out who the developer of this game is going to be. It's going to be Niantic. Are you thinking, oh, so it's just going to be another reskin of Ingress? Just like Pokemon Go was? Well, you're probably right, I would imagine. We haven't heard a lot about what this game is going to be, but given how close to Ingress Pokemon Go was, I could see this being very similar, but instead of choosing a gym, you get chosen by the choosing hat or whatever, and I'm probably screwing that name up. I only saw half the movies once. I'm sorry, everyone. But you're going to get chosen into one of the houses.
Yes.
I don't remember all the names. Gryffindor, I think, was one of them.
Hufflepuff. Slytherin.
Hufflepuff.
I think Ravenclaw.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
That's probably going to be the factions instead of, like, Team Mystic, Team Instinct, Team whatever the other one was. I don't remember.
Team Valor?
Team Valor, that's it.
Yeah.
Or like with Ingress with the Resistance versus the opposite of whatever the Resistance was. The Empire or something? I don't remember. But probably something like that.
The game itself is called Harry Potter Wizards Unite. It's currently set.
Harry Potter Go?
No. Certainly not. It is slated for a release in 2018, and the press release says that it will allow players to roam the real world, collecting power-ups, defending locations, and exploring their environment. Niantic also says that with the success it had of Pokemon Go, this game will reach an unprecedented scale, so that will certainly be something to look for, and the whole idea of Pokemon Go was that you can go out there and collect Pokemon. You can capture Pokemon, in your Pokeballs. How do you capture wizards? Is that going to be a thing? You have to, instead of a Pokeball on your screen, you have to flick your wand and cast whatever spell on them?
I don't know if it'll be capturing wizards, but there'll have to be some sort of fetch quest aspect to this, because these games only work in the context of being a treasure hunt, a global treasure hunt, basically. Right?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Like, what's... I don't know. Whatever. Surely it'll be popular, though, because people love to eat up Harry Potter stuff.
They
maybe
do.
Maybe more than they love to eat up Pokemon stuff.
I think so. I'd certainly say so. And there's a vacuum for Harry Potter content.
Yeah.
With Pokemon, it's a year-on-year franchise. There's some new Pokemon thing every year, but Harry Potter, there hasn't been for a number of years. The movie series is now ended and has for the past 5-ish years, I'd say.
I mean, the new book just came out, but they're probably not going to make a movie for it or anything.
No, I mean, there are there is the Fantastic Beasts series, which is kind of a spin-off.
Yeah.
To the Harry Potter wizard universe, set in the same wizarding world of Harry Potter, but there just hasn't been much video game content really for a number of years, so I'd certainly say there's demand, and the generation of people who kind of grew up right when Harry Potter, the books and the movies first came out, they will have their smartphones, and their kids are probably getting to the point of having smartphones too.
Yes.
And they'll have been raised on, like, mom and dad's books.
Yeah.
So, that will, there's multi-generations that you can get in there. Kind of how Pokemon was at the start with, Pokemon Go was at the start with having the first generation be what was available.
So, like what I was saying was I feel that this is going to be an even, it has the potential to be an even more popular version of what Pokemon Go was.
Yes.
Given how much more popular Harry Potter seemed to be just culturally in general than Pokemon ever was.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
And Harry Potter too, as I said, there hasn't been much in the way of gaming content in the past couple of years, but that doesn't mean it's been entirely forgotten about. If you go down to Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida, you can go visit the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, where there's a whole section of the Universal Studios theme park that's been turned over and made to look like Hogwarts Castle or, you know, the streets of London. You can go into stores. You can, you know, try and live and feel as though you are a part of the Harry Potter world.
Yeah.
Which is a really neat experience. I haven't been, but it certainly, from what I've seen and read, looks really interesting. And in a couple of years' time, in that same theme park, there will be a Nintendo World portion as well. Which leads us nicely into our next story, because we know Universal Studios, they're a big movie company, but also with theme parks. They have a deal with Nintendo for theme parks. But that may lead to a deal to produce a brand new Super Mario movie. The story this week coming out via the Wall Street Journal, which reports that Nintendo is apparently in talks with Illumination Entertainment, which is a subsidiary of Universal Studios, and apparently the two companies have been speaking about the prospect for a year of a new Super Mario Brothers movie, but now the deal is getting very close to being signed, although of course, officially no parties are speaking about it. Now, Illumination Entertainment, a name that maybe doesn't ring a bell immediately in the term of, in the land of movies in your brain, Pixar would certainly be the biggest, you know, animation or CG animation studio out there when it comes to movies. But Illumination Entertainment, you know their movies because they've done the Despicable Me movies, they've done The Secret Life of Pets, and they did the Minions movie.
Yeah, the Minions, of course, coming from the Despicable Me universe, which was initially a funny thing, but then it turned into, like, the most insufferable, annoying thing on the internet with everyone with their stupid random quotes of things with just some picture of a minion beside it for some reason.
Yes.
But doesn't mean that they're not a talented studio. I mean, their animation's good. Their movies are pretty good.
They are, and they've been very successful, made a lot of money. And it's been a long time since there's been any movie based on a Nintendo property. In fact, there was only ever one.
Yeah, and that was a critical and commercial flop. I know I do have friends that really enjoy the movie genuinely, but I feel that they also recognize that it's actually a bad movie. And, you know, I'll watch it, but I'll also know how bad it actually is. And the movie, of course, was the Super Mario Brothers movie back from 1993, starring Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo.
Yes. The live action adaptation of the Super Mario Brothers, basically at the height of Mario Mania in the early 90s.
Yeah. So, I mean, thankfully that movie didn't really do much to kill Mario Mania, but it certainly didn't do much to help Mario Mania.
No, it didn't, but I think, that kind of makes it an interesting footnote in Mario's history and reception, certainly in North America, given that how popular he was. And then, of course, the logical idea is you spin Mario off into anything possible, t-shirts, shoes, snacks, breakfast cereals, cartoons, and then a movie. That's kind of the ultimate height that in a popular piece of entertainment can reach. And my God, did the movie not even come close to being authentic to the universe that was portrayed in the source material video games?
Oh, exactly. It was pretty different. pretty horrifying in lots of different ways that the games never were.
Like the Koopa Troopas?
And the Goombas, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good God, but it'll be interesting to see how they play it. I kind of hope that they keep Mario a silent protagonist, because that's sort of what he's been known as in all the Mario games over the past 15, 20 years.
He has, and just have everyone around him do the talking?
Yeah, and like anytime he goes to talk, have people jump in to go, oh, what Mario probably means is blah, blah, blah.
I mean, he does make utterances and noises and a few very slight phrases. You could almost treat it like a Minions.
Yeah, maybe.
With slightly less annoying language.
Yeah. And only one Mario.
Yes, and only one Mario. Well, baby Mario, but yes, just one.
Oh, we don't even need that. That's fine.
One singular Mario. And when I first kind of read this story, the fact that it was Illumination Entertainment that they were talking to, I kind of like, because if you look at the animation style of Despicable Me and Minions, that seems in line with Nintendo and what a Super Mario movie would be.
Yeah.
It's a very bright, very cartoonish and colorful style that they have.
Yeah, and the characters aren't trying to be super realistic looking. They have their own kind of bubbly style. Fits in well with the Mushroom Kingdom.
It does, and I can see this being a very bright and colorful experience on the big screen. And perhaps Nintendo needed that terrible experience of the Mario Brothers movie from 1993, because as part of the report that the company is close to signing with Illumination Entertainment, as part of this supposed deal, Shigeru Miyamoto would serve as a producer on the film.
Potentially, yes.
Potentially serve as a producer on the film, which did not happen with the 1993 movie. Basically, Nintendo just had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Yeah, so I guess because of that bad experience and with their intellectual property kind of running amok, they've made it a point this time that they want to do more than just license something. To pull a quote from Nintendo, I guess from GameSpot.com, from Chris Pereira.
Yeah, who cites the source Wall Street Journal, which then turns around and cites people familiar with the workings and potential deal here. Potentially there's several movies that could be part of this deal, but Nintendo would just kind of take it one at a time.
Yeah, they're going one at a time right now. They don't want to go too far. They don't want to have another 1993 on their hands.
Certainly. And I can see how this deal would come about, with Nintendo dealing with Universal Studios for the theme park stuff. And then, oh, by the way, hey, we have this animation division that is doing these movies. Why don't you go talk to them? See what you can do. See if there's any synergy. And likely came about that way. My only hope for this is that they do not replace the current voice of Mario for this movie with some other big name Hollywood voice actor who is simply there because of name recognition.
But we all know that that will happen, so...
Do it to Luigi, do it to Princess Peach, whatever, fine. Those who don't have recognizable, defined voices. Mario does.
But he doesn't, because it was Captain Lou Albano to start with. And then it turned into, like, a completely different voice for a while.
True.
And then he was just sort of, like, this mostly silent type.
And now it's, I believe, Charles Martinet is the name, if I recall correctly. I'm going off the top of my head.
I don't know. There's probably some clause in Charles Martinet's contract that says he has to be the voice forever until he dies. To which Nintendo replied, that can be arranged. As they're eyeing Bob Hoskins again. But
the amazing thing about that movie is that two of the best actors of modern times both wanted nothing to do with that movie after, and they both regarded it as a black spot on their filmography.
Yeah.
Like, Dennis Hopper and Bob Hoskins were embarrassed by it.
Oh, absolutely. And those are two of the greatest actors of that time. Like, without a doubt.
So, with that in mind, that's a total the money cleared movie.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, that's fine. I got paid. I can move on and live with myself. I got a new house in France for this, so I'm golden.
Exactly.
But some other Nintendo news, as we have spoken about, it's been quite the turnaround year for the company, with sales of the Switch, being very solid since its launch in March. And another report from the Wall Street Journal saying that, well, Nintendo, as they've said, and Reggie Fils-Aimé has said from the late summer now going into the fall, that they would ramp up production to try and have enough Switch units to meet the demand going into the holiday shopping season. Well, apparently, sources with direct knowledge of Nintendo's planning say that, the company plans to significantly increase its production of Switch units, starting in the next, fiscal year, with sources telling the Wall Street Journal that the company plans to potentially produce somewhere between 25 to 30 million units in the next fiscal year, which starts and goes from April 2018 to March 2019. So to date, they've sold over 7 million, and with the holiday shopping season now in full swing and only going to ramp up, it is quite possible that within the first year of its life, the Switch sells more than what the Wii U did in its life cycle, which is about 13 to 14 million units.
Yeah.
In 1 year. And that's with Nintendo scrambling and trying to continually up and up and up its production through this year. To then increase it to 25 to 30 million units in the next year would be kind of crazy.
Yeah.
That's just units produced.
That is units produced. I mean, of course, given Nintendo's track record, I feel like you have to take this with a grain of salt, because they say stuff like this all the time, like, well, we're going to have plenty more Super Nintendo Classic units, which they had a little bit more, but not really enough.
Well, they did for one day, and
then never again.
Haven't seen them back in store since.
Yeah.
And it's a cat and mouse game. Seemingly still now with the Super Nintendo Classic to try and find it. But of course, these plans have not been confirmed by Nintendo itself. But apparently, this is what Nintendo is telling its business partners about these plans. But apparently, Tatsumi Kimishima has said in the past that they'll monitor the Switch sales through the holidays and see if upping the production is necessary to meet the demand.
Okay. Okay, completely out of touch executive. All right. If you say so. But maybe something that'll help sell the Switch, just in case it wasn't selling enough, apparently, or something, is that it will get its very first streaming app. Just to touch on one final thing about the Switch here this week.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get its first video streaming app. And they're treating that like a big deal for some reason, despite the fact that the last two generations of all the other systems have already had plenty of video streaming apps. But good old Nintendo finally coming into the fray, like 7 to 10 years late.
Well, hey, there were, the streaming apps for the Wii and the Wii U, but it was a curiosity that the Switch didn't have at the start. And there was no mention of any plans for when those things would eventually come to the Switch. But the first one being Hulu. Not Netflix, but Hulu.
Interesting.
So if you're in Canada and have a Switch, you are kind of SOL. You will not be able to partake in streaming video yet through Hulu, because that's not here.
No, it's not. But that's what's going to be on the Switch, so good.
It's, I believe, was just released, I believe, about 2 weeks ago. It's available through the Switch eShop. Just as a free download, but only in the U.S., and all it took was 8 months after launch of the system to get its first video streaming service. No word yet if this means Netflix, YouTube, Amazon Prime, or anything of that nature will be making their way to the Nintendo Switch anytime soon.
You know, all the main ones that most people are expecting them to have?
You know, like Netflix, especially Netflix.
But also YouTube, both of those in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Even Amazon Prime? No. Whatever.
And the interesting thing is, that has not been a detriment or an impediment to sales at all.
No. Which is why I find it funny that they're even trying at this point. It's like, on the one hand, it would have been kind of cool if they just kind of like stuck a middle finger in the air and said, we're a game console. We're not a media thing. This is for games and only games. I could have respected that. It's like, cause yeah, I have a million other devices that have Netflix on it. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
But like if my Switch is already on, why would I bother booting up another thing just to go to Netflix? Right?
True too. That would certainly be quite the draw on, or potentially be a draw on battery power further. I mean, if you're using it in handheld mode.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. I mean, like, I'm in my living room.
Well, yes, but also it's portable, so you can take it on the go. So if you've already got it out there with you.
That's true.
And you're tired of gaming on the bus, just, I need a break from Breath of the Wild or what have you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's likely just there to be a thing that you kind of need to have at this point.
Yeah. Whenever they release apps that everyone can use. That is to say, sure. Maybe this is actually a subtle sign that Hulu is going to be making inroads in Canada a little bit more. Is that what we can take from this? I don't think so.
No, I doubt that.
But that'd be interesting.
It would be interesting, but unlikely at this point.
Yeah.
Given the monopoly that, well, really just one company has for streaming services here in Canada.
Yeah, Crave TV is a pretty...
Well, outside of Netflix, that's all there is.
Yeah, there used to be Show Me, but it wasn't that great, and it also is dead now, so, oh well.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you don't have the rights to the HBO programming, so...
It's true.
So, there you go. But, yeah, I mean, if and when Netflix comes to the Switch in both the United States and Canada, we here at the Arcade will let you know and have more, you know, snide in derision for it then as well.
Absolutely.
Snark, if you will.
Yes.
We are rich in snark and spirit.
And swarth.
And also, at this present moment, nostalgia as well, as we move into our last segment of the program, the Blast from the Past, which, if you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you'll know, is when we take a few minutes to reminisce about things gone by. Could be a television program, a movie, book, album, some piece of media or entertainment from days gone by that we think is worth spending a few minutes to talk about, discuss, reminisce, kind of laugh, cajole, needle, whatever the case might be. And we have two items in the Blast from the Past this week. They are both video games, and they are both some of the biggest video game franchises that got their start, respectively, 10 years ago.
I was actually going to say... It seems like 10 years ago, almost to the date, I want to say the current generation's standards for AAA titles were set by these two game franchises that really upped the quality and made everyone around them up the quality a little bit.
And both this year, they saw new games released in the franchise.
Yeah.
Normally we separate items between age and go younger, older, older, younger, but we can't. There's no separating them. They are both 10 years old, so the question is, do you want to start with the console-specific one or the multi-platform title?
I don't think it matters.
Okay, then alphabetically, we shall start with Assassin's Creed.
Excellent.
The title that, the first Assassin's Creed title before the naming scheme got somewhat convoluted, but still early on in the franchise set forth by Ubisoft, developed by, I believe, Ubisoft Montreal, Ubisoft Paris, a number of Ubisoft studios contributed to it, for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. It was released on November 13th of the year 2007, and this was the first one. Even though the most recent release was titled Assassin's Creed Origins, this is the origins of the game franchise, which saw the introduction of Desmond Miles, who was the modern-day protagonist for the first couple games, the idea of going back into your biological, genealogical ancestry through your memories, with the Animus, the big contraption where you can go and revisit your ancestors, Abstergo, the big conspiracy between the Templars trying to control the world, and also the Order of Assassins who've been defending the world and trying to keep individual freedom since forever, and just laid a huge, rich world onto the gaming public with this first game that saw you play as your ancestor Altair in the Holy Land way back in the 12th century, I believe it was, and set forth the mechanics that we know and understand an Assassin's Creed game to be to this day.
Yeah. I mean, full disclosure, I never really played the first Assassin's Creed game. I really kind of picked up the series more with the second one, but yeah, I do know that it definitely established a lot of like the things that we even see now, you know, the crazy, building scaling, the parkour kind of aspect. Mm-hmm. It was really, it kind of built on the Prince of Persia franchise that Ubisoft had worked on previous to this.
Yes.
Sort of with some of the parkour and like some of the visual style and everything, except they took a lot of it to crazy extremes that they didn't have in the Prince of Persia franchise, and also no rewind either.
No real manipulation of time as a gameplay mechanic.
But yeah, like the idea that the thing that really got me about Assassin's Creed was the diving into things from high heights. The crazy dives. Like, I didn't really see that in a game before, to the point where like it was encouraged to do that. Like every other game where that happens, like, oh, I slipped and died. Whoops. Because of course you did. You just fell 300 feet from the sky. Yeah, you're dead. But this one, nope.
Oh, there's a conveniently placed hay bale underneath. Well, here we go.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's such a graceful fall, too.
Yeah, and it's always done with, you know, you see the angles, and it's like, oh, it looks like a, you know, like an Olympic swimmer diving or something. Like, that's very, very graceful.
10-meter, you know, dive off the platform.
Yeah,
there
exactly.
Yes, that as well. Other, you know, standard tropes like the hidden blades that we see to just go and assassinate people stealthily.
Yep.
Blending into the crowds. Also, maybe having to take cover and lie low if you've been too recognized, aka you've gone on a, you know, bloody conquest and killed too many people and the guards have found out and you're being chased to high hell.
Yep.
Yeah, that mechanic. Which is really just kind of boring from Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah. I mean, your star level will go up.
Yeah.
And get, you know, if you get 5 stars, you're screwed.
But very quickly, it's game over. But, yeah, I know a lot of people in the critical reception, of Assassin's Creed back in the day of 2007 was, you know, to like the idea, like the mechanics it brought forward, but it felt boring. It felt dull.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we saw Assassin's Creed 2 with Ezio in, you know, ancient Italy.
Yeah.
That we kind of really saw the Assassin's Creed franchise take off.
Yeah, we saw what it really could be, but I mean, a lot of the ideas were really set up there. Genetic memories, going back in time to some sort of historical place, living out pseudo history, like kind of like speculative history where you actually interact with historical figures and you have to kind of, in many ways, you actually learn about history playing Assassin's Creed games. I know one of my siblings was super into Assassin's Creed and ended up knowing all of the stuff about the Borgias because of playing through Assassin's Creed. It's like when that series came out, it's like, oh, I don't need to watch that series. I played through all of Assassin's Creed 2 and 3 or whatever. It's like, what? It's like, oh yeah, he slept with her. He killed her. She did this to him, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's all explained. It's like, what? Okay, so I guess you're just a history buff now, too. Whatever. I thought you just liked video games. Fine.
But there is a historical basis to them.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it's, you're interacting with it, but what better way to learn history than to kind of interact with it and to kind of immerse yourself in it, right?
It's true. It's very true. But then it goes off and sets a whole world of fiction around that as well. Yeah.
Like, it builds a story into the history, so, but it weaves itself around and it respects the history though. So anything that you do and anything that happens isn't interfering with anything. Mm-hmm. They just kind of write it in a way that seems like it could be plausible to happen alongside.
And a game like this kind of, in looking back on it now, feels like it was a big risk on the part of Ubisoft at the time, This was a new franchise, a new property. They had success with Prince of Persia and, you know, the decade prior.
Yeah.
Which was an established franchise. They've tried rebooting it since and it's failed miserably.
Yeah.
Cause Prince of Persia's kind of played out and also been replaced in importance in the Ubisoft stable by Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
But also too, in the first one, they set out and you can tell there's a huge world, a huge fiction, a huge mythology and mythos to the game that you're playing. More becomes clear as you play later games, but also just there's so much there established already that if it had failed, then a lot of work that went into it would have been for naught.
Oh, exactly. But
which was kind of crazy. And, of course, well, storyline went on. I mean, the modern-day storyline of the game really doesn't matter because you're buying these games to go play the historical aspect of them.
Yeah.
And go run around and climb up the side of the, you know, Colosseum in Rome or, you know, the side of a pyramid in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, or like the Sistine Chapel as it's being painted kind of thing in
exactly.
Italy. Like,
yeah, you got to go help Michelangelo.
Yeah, you or like Leonardo da Vinci has missions for you. Oh, okay.
He's your version of Q and hooks you up with some new gear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which does seem historically plausible. Like, it doesn't seem like it would be insane and out of the ordinary, but yeah, that's Assassin's Creed.
Ten
years old, certainly you can, you know, grab a copy of it on some sort of thing on one of the systems it came out for, PS3 or Xbox 360, for probably cheap at this point.
Oh god, cheap like borscht. I wonder if the original one, the first Assassin's Creed game with Altair, I wonder if that's something they'll go back and revisit, because...
Like, or do an HD remaster for the current
HD remaster of, because it kind of feels lost. I mean, the Ezio Saga was a 3-game span.
Yeah.
And that just really launched the... that was rocket fuel for the whole franchise and for Ubisoft. So the first one with Altair feels just kind of forgotten about in that sense.
Yeah.
But... A franchise that is not forgotten about, as I said, had a new entry into its franchise this year. And as you noted when we were going through, saying it's one of the most movie-like of game franchises right now, Uncharted.
Yeah. I know like it's also celebrating a 10-year anniversary, as we mentioned before. But yeah, I never really played much of the Uncharted franchise. Except, like, I had Uncharted 1 and 2 because they came with my PlayStation 3 when I bought it way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that they always looked good, but I had other games to play. But I finally had sat down and played a bit of Uncharted 4, and holy crap, it actually looks like a movie. And that's something that they sort of established early on with their animation style of how much better than a lot of other games that, you know, were out at the time they were going for, because the first Uncharted looked incredible.
It sure did. It was breathtaking with it, and it looked cinematic from the outset. Like, they were specifically trying to make almost a CG movie.
Yeah.
But one that was interactive as well, and had gameplay mechanics. And it was... it certainly had the feel of, like, an Indiana Jones, but a modern Indiana Jones feel to it, which we haven't really seen. I mean, hell, there hasn't been a good Indiana Jones game.
No. I mean, the closest that we had previous to that would have been Tomb Raider, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And I think that's, you know, the first Uncharted game, Drake's Fortune, was compared to Tomb Raider as being, you know, a new, you know, dude Tomb Raider.
Like, dude Raider.
Yeah. But, and naturally so, but I think it kind of went in its own direction and established that it's not or wasn't a Tomb Raider ripoff at all.
No.
And so the first one you play Nathan Drake, who goes on a crazy adventure, one of those globe-spanning adventures to basically in search of fortune.
Yeah, trying to get the legendary treasure of El Dorado in South America. With, you know, Elena Fisher and who's the journalist, and with your mentor, Victor Sully Sullivan, while trying to dodge pirates and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And Hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue, and it feels very much like a globetrotting epic adventure, because it is. You have so many different set pieces and locations.
Yeah.
Providing a lot of diversity to the experience. I mean, you're in the Caribbean, you're on the high seas, you're flying, you're... I can't even remember all the locations you go to in the first one.
You're on a boat, you're going through the jungle.
I think you go to Europe at some point, or the Middle East.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going off the top of my head, don't sue me.
Lots of set pieces.
Yes, it's huge set pieces, and variety of gameplay too. I mean, driving vehicles,
like
one-on-one, stealth, puzzles.
Platforming.
But it all feels natural.
Yeah, none of it feels like it's taking you to a different game, just cutting away to a different type of game for no reason or something. Like,
no.
None of it felt like it was experimenting with forms or anything. It all felt very natural. It might have been experimenting with forms, but it did it in such a way that it was kind of transparent.
It did, and organic, and made sense for the experience. And I think one of the things, at least in my mind, that kind of makes Uncharted stand out is how different it is a game compared to the previous games that its developers had released. Because Uncharted, Drake's Fortune, was developed by Naughty Dog Studios. Naughty Dog being a game company, a game maker, that previously had been best known for some of its entries on the PlayStation and PlayStation 2, more cartoony platformers.
Yeah, I mean, the most notable previous franchise before Uncharted would have been Crash Bandicoot, and probably the second most notable being Jak and Daxter.
Yes.
You know, very kind of like, I don't want to say they're the same type of game, but kind of more anthropomorphic animals, cartoonish environments, over the top, you know, more traditional kind of like cartoony video game stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Uncharted was going for something a lot more realistic, which I thought was kind of surprising when I saw the name Naughty Dog attached to it. I thought, the Crash Bandicoot people did this?
Because prior to that, I mean, doing Crash Bandicoot and then Jak and Daxter, you establish yourself as being, okay, well, this is who we are and this is what we do as a studio.
Yeah.
There's multiple games to those. They weren't one-offs.
No, like, there was, like, 8 Crash Bandicoot games, if you count the racing games and all that, too.
Like, and I think there was, like, 5 or 6 Jak and Daxters.
Yeah, but it's very impressive that they were able to kind of transition into the Uncharted franchise, and then later, The Last of Us.
Yes.
And upcoming The Last of Us 2, which is a pretty hotly anticipated title, but, yeah. I guess if you were, you know, if you were like me, a kid back in the late 90s playing the first couple of Crash Bandicoot games, if you would have told me the people that, you know, made this game, they're going to like revolutionize, you know, and kind of set the bar for how 3D games should look in about 10 years, I would have said, what, really? Crash Bandicoot people? Like, this is just a fun, silly game.
Mm-hmm. It's simple.
Yeah, like, you mean to tell me that they're gonna make, like, cinematic, crazy, like, realistic-looking games? You're out of your mind.
Oh, they're gonna know how to get some of the best performance out of this piece of hardware? Because yeah. Uncharted was one of the best-looking games on PlayStation 3.
Yeah, hands down.
And really showed, oh, this is really what the system can do.
Yeah, but even when I played Uncharted 4, my mind was blown, because I honestly hadn't seen an animation that good at that point yet. Still haven't really. I mean, it's like, I've played a lot of decent looking games, but Uncharted 4 in particular is like, holy crap. And then I saw the trailer for The Last of Us 2 and was like, okay, well.
Well, you have to get The Last of Us first.
Yeah.
Get ready.
We'll see. We'll see if I can deal with a game like that. But,
but that's, for something in the future. But, yeah, so kind of wild to think that within a week's span, the span of really 6 days, in 2007, 2, major AAA game franchises were released and established.
And they both really set the bar really high for AAA games from that point forward.
And, even though there's been, what I should say is Uncharted really hasn't had a dip in quality through the four games in the franchise.
No.
There's been variations in the Assassin's Creed franchise. I think through some of them, as the Ezio saga kind of went along, and then maybe Black Flag and some of the ones after Black Flag and Assassin's Creed were a little...
And it became a little bit too much of a yearly franchise?
Yes. Yeah. But Assassin's Creed Origin certainly looks to be doing new things with the series. But that was all kind of first established back on the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 on November 13th, 2007, when the first Assassin's Creed game was released. And then 6 days later, on the PlayStation 3, exclusive to that platform, was Uncharted Drake's Fortune. Like I said, and like we've said, it's wild that that's what you got in a week.
Yeah.
There's not enough hours and not enough money for that, but that's what it was, and that's hell of a thing. So, if you have a PlayStation 3, still have one that's working, running, and hooked up for some weird reason, and you want to enjoy some 10-year-old nostalgia, bust out those and let us know your thoughts. Do they still hold up compared to their very modern counterparts and modern releases of games in that franchise? Let us know. You can email us info@thearcadeshow.com. You can also send us a message through Twitter. We are at The Arcade Show, and follow us while you're doing that. And send us a message on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Follow our page while you're there. And for all your arcade needs of previous episodes and whatnot, and to ensure that you get all the latest episodes of The Arcade delivered right to your digital device, we recommend you subscribe to us through your favorite podcatcher, through iTunes, through the Google Play section. You can find direct links to our pages on both those platforms on our homepage, thearcadeshow.com. So until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.
Boom, 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 boom,